Gamar Joba, and welcome to the History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. I'm your host, Roberto, and this is Myth 2, Medea. We're going to be ending the tale of our lovers, Jason and Medea, with a summarization of Euripides' play, Medea. After our summarization, we'll follow it up with a discussion with our editor, Brendan, so make sure to see our beautiful mugs on YouTube. Welcome back to the campfire, my friends. Take a seat and listen well. Today I shall be ending the tale of our lovers, Jason and Medea. We last left them off with their successful return from obtaining the Golden Fleece of Colchis, landing on the island of Anafe, and throwing a festival on their successful return to their homeland. What happened after Jason returned to Iolcus with the Golden Fleece? Let's find out. Years after the legendary journey, we enter upon a very different world in the land of Corinth. Cries reverberate throughout the walls of Medea and Jason's home. Medea's nurse enters the stage and delivers a monologue lamenting her mistress's grief, cursing Jason for his treachery, and wishing he had never stepped aboard the Argo. If it weren't for Jason, Medea would never have persuaded Pelias' daughters to kill their father and cause their exile to Corinth. Medea gave everything she could for Jason, and what did Jason give in return? Why, he deserted Medea and their children to take the daughter of King Creon, Glauce, as a wife in order to secure his bloodline. Medea continued to weep over the broken vows she and Jason made before the gods to always love and be faithful to each other. Out of disgust with Jason, she even refused to see the two children she bore him. Medea's nurse voiced her fears that Medea would not be able to withstand these slights and might be plotting to bring King Creon's and Jason's life to an end. If there is one thing Jason will learn by the end of this story, it's not to betray Medea of Colchis. As the nurse finished her monologue, the children's tutor entered, delivering the news that Creon was on his way to exile Medea and her children from Corinth to make room for Jason's children with Glauce in the royal court, and out of fear of what she might do in retaliation. The tutor even mentioned that Jason did not protest this decision, as old ties give ways to new ones. Medea's sorrow attracts the play's chorus, the Corinthian women, who give their support and join the nurse. Medea's cries morph into a sea of curses against Jason and their mutual progeny, and she petitions the gods to strike her down and end her suffering. King Creon of Corinth arrives at Medea's home, flanked by his attendants. He approaches Medea and informs her that she is now exiled from the land of Corinth, along with her two children. The sentence is immediate, and he wants her gone now, and will not leave her side with his guards until she is well out of the confines of his land. Medea, ever so clever, knows the reason that she was exiled, but asks the reasoning to buy herself time to decide in her own favor. Creon responds that he is afraid Medea may mortally injure his daughter, Glauce, for Jason's betrayal. Creon knows that Medea is an intelligent woman and a powerful sorceress, and it's no secret that she threatened the lives of Jason and Glauce. Medea objects that she is not as clever as people believe her to be, and has no plans of harming him, as he is king and has done no wrong in finding the best suitor for his daughter. She just wants to continue living peacefully among the Corinthians with her children, and will remain silent and submissive to her betters if she is allowed to stay. Creon, nevertheless, does not trust her and exiles her as enemy of Corinth. Medea begs to be allowed to stay, but acquiesces to exile in the end. However, she begs for a single day to get her affairs in order and find a way to support her children, as she can no longer rely on Jason's support. Exile was only a step above a death sentence in ancient Greece, and although she would not mind exile if she were childless, she would not be able to care for her children outside the protective walls of the city. Creon relents and allows her to stay in Corinth for a day, but threatens that if the morning light touches her the next day, it would be the doom of her and her children. With no time left to lose, she immediately sets to plotting and comes to the best conclusion she can think of. Her plan? Murder. It's always murder. Come on, Medea. Can't you get a new way to punish people? No longer able to bear the dishonor of Jason's betrayal, Medea plans to leave bodies in her wake as she exits from Corinth. She thinks of several ways to deliver her enemies to the gates of Hades while escaping persecution. But in every scenario she thinks up, she realizes that both she and her children end up dead. She swears to honor her patron goddess Hecate by ruining Jason's new marriage. She steels herself by reminding herself that she is the granddaughter of Helios, the sun himself, and that as a woman, her cleverness can get her out of any predicament. The chorus, overhearing Medea, adds that men are the most deceitful ones of all, and that women must be paid their due. They point out that Jason dishonored her in her own bed and made her a refugee. She has lost everything, and not even her father's house is available to her for sanctuary. Enter Jason. Jason enters with his attendants and proceeds to say in an overly condescending way how much he tried to help Medea avoid exile, but that her own anger is the cause of her banishment from Corinth. He extends a hand of friendship to Medea and offers to, oh so graciously, provide her and her children with money so that they are not destitute. Jason's words irk Medea even more, and she describes how she aided him in all endeavors. She reminds him that she even committed fratricide to stop the Colchians from catching him. Jason, she points out, will live in luxury in the court of King Creon while she and her children are forced into destitution in spite of the money he sends her. Offended by this, Jason retorts that her love for him was not his fault, as it was Aphrodite that blinded her with love. In spite of the fact that he could not have possibly succeeded without her help, he insists that he has done way more for her than she has done for him because, quote, firstly, instead of living among barbarians, you inhabit a Greek land and understand our ways, how to live by law instead of a sweet will of force. Wrong move there, Jason. You had a chance to make things up with Medea, but you just broke any chance you had. And did you just call Medea's people, the Colchians, barbarians? This is the part in the story where I personally lost any sympathy for Jason. And what else would he like to add to this argument? Oh yes! That he has both Medea and her children's best interest in mind. How could he not take the opportunity to marry into wealth and royalty with Glauce? If anything, if Medea had not made a fuss, she could have remained as his mistress and her children would have had the chance to grow up beside their fully Greek brothers. Yeah, you just dug your grave, Jason. Medea and the chorus of women do not believe this at all. Jason attempts to give gifts to Medea to placate her feelings, but she rejects them. Jason leaves, and Medea is feeling even more scorned now with Jason's absolutely horrible persuasion skills. Remember us mentioning how he would try to be persuasive in the last episode? Yeah, he's not the most persuasive person. Medea's plans of murder have now been solidified, and this will be one marriage Jason will most certainly regret making. Although she is not lacking in determination, Medea has a thing for burning bridges, so she is lacking in allies. Just when she thought she was friendless, the gods sent an ally in the form of Aegeus, king of Athens, who is on the way back from asking the oracle how to best conceive a child. After hearing of his plight, Medea offers to aid him in conceiving a child with his wife, if he grants her refuge in Athens, even if neighboring kingdoms demand her return. Aegeus, oblivious to Medea's nefarious plan, agrees and continues on to Athens. Having found her exit strategy, she begins to scheme once again in earnest. Medea orders the servants to go and find Jason and bring her to him. She'll convince him that she agrees to the marriage and will leave, but he must convince Glauce to tell her father to allow the children to remain. In doing so, she then plans to have her children give a wedding gift to Glauce, the golden robe of Helios and a golden crown, which are both family heirlooms. She knows Glauce will be unable to resist wearing the clothes and laces them with poison to kill the princess. Of course, since her children are delivering the robes, they will perish as well, but robbing Jason of his future seems the best way to inflict the most pain onto him. Jason returns, and Medea gives her apologies, quotation marks, and sends a wedding gift to Glauce along with her children. Time passes, and Medea ponders over her actions. The tutor then arrives and tells her that the children have successfully given the gifts to the princess. Soon enough, a messenger arrives and tells Medea of the success of her plan. Glauke, immediately upon seeing the beautiful robe, dressed into it and felt the effects of the poison. She went weak, collapsed, and burst into flames? I would say that's a horrible way to die, but then again, Heracles died the exact same way. Distraught, Creon rushes to save her, only to also burst into flames upon touching her charred corpse. Well, the plan worked, I guess. Medea then decides to murder her own children, only hesitating for a moment to consider the pain it would cause her, but decides that she would like to inflict as much harm on Jason as possible. The chorus is upset with the children's pain, but ends up doing nothing to help. Jason, discovering what had happened to Glauke and Creon, rushes over to the family home to punish Medea, only to learn about the deaths of his progeny. He encounters Medea standing over his children's corpses in the courtyard. In a bit of stagecraft notably reserved for only the gods, Medea taunts Jason as she escapes in a flying chariot like that of her grandfather Helios to escape from her enemies. Jason, in rage, cries that her children's blood now stains her hands and that he is now childless and will be unable to speak to his children alive ever again. Jason says that the Furies will come after Medea for killing her children, but Medea retorts that the gods do not lend an ear to oathbreakers and deceivers. Jason, using the children as an argument, talks about how much he loved them and how he wishes to be with them once more. Medea, a better wordslinger than Jason can ever hope to be, in disgust says, quote, "Now you would speak to them, now you would kiss them, then you rejected them." Mind you, this is the first time Jason has even given his children attention in weeks. In anger, Medea prophesizes that Jason will meet a horrible end beneath the mass of the rotting Argo and makes her way to Athens with her dead children in tow. Jason stands in the courtyard, despairing at his loss of a future.
Hello, everyone. I'm Trevor Cully, host of the History of Persia podcast. From its earliest recorded history, the empires of ancient Persia left indelible marks on the landscape of Sakartvelo. Whether it was fire altars or Roman battle scars, Persian influence was inescapable. The phrase ancient Persia usually makes people think about failed invasions of Greece, but places like Greece and Georgia were at the very fringes of the first Persian Empire. The history of Persia weaves through the stories of Egypt, Babylon, Afghanistan, and even the Bible. And it didn't end with the conquests of Alexander the Great. The heirs to that Persian Empire would go on to reassemble most of Alexander's kingdom, halt the Roman eastward advance, very nearly conquer Constantinople, and act as the nexus of communication and trade between Africa, China, India, and Europe, before ultimately being conquered by the Arab expansion of the 7th century. If the stories of ancient Persia interest you, come check out the History of Persia podcast. You can find me online at historyofpersiapodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, like this one.
Gamar Joba, everyone. We will begin including mid-episode breaks from now on. I'd like to take this time to talk about the music of the show. So, our normal intro song for the narrative is Hanchi Shesulo Metchfare, An Old Shepherd, by Kesane. And for the cultural episodes, such as myths, movies, literature, books, etc., the intro will be I'm Tazeda, Here It Is on the Mountain, by 33A. Our outro song will remain Tuase Turpa Iyavi, If You Are So Beautiful / Beloved, by Hamlet Gonashvili. I don't speak Georgian, but I am learning, so pardon my translations. I'm trying my best. Now, remember that I do have a website with all our sources on the web, as well as great pictures you can look at relating to the podcast. It's also a great way to look us up on social media. It's historyofsakartvelo.com. Spelling will be provided on the end of the episode. Now back to our regularly scheduled podcast. Well, we now make our way to our discussion about Medea with Brendan. You heard from him last time during Jason and the Argonauts, so let's see what he has to say about Medea.
And welcome back to the show, Brendan. How are you doing?
You know what? I'm doing fine. I'm mentally exhausted because I was working all day, but other than that, I'm doing fine. I mean, it's Wednesday, so, like, weekend is almost here, I guess.
Hump day!
Yeah, it's hump day. I never understood, like, why, like, I never understood that idiom until, like, I started having a full-time job and was like, oh, you start looking forward to
the weekend.
The end of the week.
Yeah, it's like back when we were in school, it didn't feel the same as when you start working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, well, tomorrow is Thursday, which means it's basically Saturday.
Yep. So we're back here. We're going to talk about Euripides' play, Medea. So we actually have some discussion points to kind of streamline this, because last time we took over an hour and a half with a lot of tangents.
Yeah. And also, how long is Jason and the Argonauts? It was like four books.
Jason and the Argonaut was four books, and in my version of the book, it was about 140 pages.
Oh, okay. Well, I listened to the audiobook of Medea on LibriVox. Just shout out to whoever does LibriVox for free, because I love LibriVox. That took like an hour and 45 minutes for them to read through it.
Yeah, it took me like 45 minutes to read it. Literally sat down. Then, like, 45 minutes later, I'm like, oh, that's it. I thought it would be longer.
Yeah, I thought it'd be longer, too. I guess I'm not familiar at all with ancient Greek drama. I can tell you the plots of a lot of stories because they've been, like, recounted to me in books about Greek mythology. But actual Greek dramas I've never studied or read.
Well, I can provide a bit of a historical background. Usually you would have like competitions between writers, and the plays would show in sets of three. So right. Usually three writers would be competing to see who had the better play. And so this one, Euripides' Medea, actually was in that competition and got third place, because the Greeks didn't like a lot of what went on in the actual play. But I think it's a spectacular play. Like, and the best thing is it all takes place in one place. So like you don't have any scene changes. And basically you just have to rely on like the actors and narrators to kind of give you all the information.
Yeah, I mean, that's one difficulty I have with plays actually is one of my old professors, Dr. Goldstein, who retired, he was like giving away all his books.
Retired.
He really was. Besides, anyway, if I stole him from his office, he probably wouldn't care. Like, professors are always trying to get rid of books, in my experience. But like, I tried to read The Iceman Cometh, and I'm used to like the prose of novels. And so I like tried to read it and I just didn't enjoy it because like it was just dialogue. Nobody was describing the scene except like a couple stage directions, which are intentionally sparse. So I guess that's why my experience was better when I was listening to it as an audiobook, because they just had to let the dialogue between the actors imply everything. It kind of reminds me of reading Macbeth, where like, remember the scene where Lady Macbeth is hallucinating a knife that is in front of her? Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And I had like, I remember reading that for the first time and my teacher had to explain to me, because I didn't understand what was going on or what she was talking about. It was like, no, you have to like, basically the actors had to a lot of the time imagine what their character would be doing in a scene based solely on the dialogue. There were stage directions and there are props, but a lot of it was up to interpretation of just the play.
Yeah, so basically, so plays are usually left up to interpretation, and because especially if the older tragedies, it's kind of hard to see what they mean because you can't go ahead and ask the writer like, hey, what do you mean for this part? And a lot of it, usually, you know, they're wearing masks, and so so each character has their own mask, so that way you wouldn't identify the actors beneath them, and but you would know which character it was because of that mask. And so one thing that I always found like interesting about just older plays is that they're not that fun to read, but they're really fun to like watch like being performed. It's because like you kind of have to deal with everything going on like in front of you and kind of take it in at once. But I always have had an issue with like more modern renditions of like these tragic plays. And for me, it was like, oh, like I'm a bit of an originalist when it comes to like theater. So like, you know, if it was written, it says, you know, it has to be a certain dress, has to be a certain way, because I don't like it when people start changing stuff from like the historical background of things.
Yeah, there's a lot of, they kind of have to do that because after a certain time, everybody's seen Macbeth, so you have to. There's one reinterpretation of Macbeth, which was just a one-man show, and it was like one guy playing all the characters, and he was like in an insane asylum, and he was just talking to himself.
I mean, there's always caveats because I've enjoyed, because don't laugh at me, but I've really enjoyed the Romeo and Juliet with DiCaprio in it.
I mean, I don't know. It's a '90s classic. Did it come out in '90s, like 2000?
Yeah, early late '90s. It's from the '90s for sure.
Yeah.
But that was one of my favorites because that was like the first time I ever saw like something like that. But most of the time, it's when it's done. When I've seen them live, I haven't enjoyed them because I just have my own idea of what they look like. But you know, there's always caveats to what I enjoy. And you know, sometimes I'll go back and watch, you know, or go see a play or something that I've seen before, and I'm like, oh, I actually like that this time. Because, you know, we evolve with age. But I'm just more of an originalist, and my roommates will complain about that all the time. And I'm like, oh, yeah, no, if it's not written in the book, you know, it's not canon. but that's just me. But and also with plays, there's a lot of, like, directors have different images and everything. But let's get off this tangent. one of the characters is, as you know, most Greek plays tend to have a chorus in them, which is just a group of people that perform in the play. So, and this chorus,
the role of the chorus is like to basically tell the audience what's going on. The chorus like is very passive most of the time. For one reason or another within the story, and we'll get to why the Corinthian women chorus aren't involved in the story. They just comment on what's going on, basically.
Kind of like your proto-narrator.
Yeah, basically. And in this, my point here, because we discussed all these points before the camera started rolling, was that the Corinthian women, I think, have a monologue near the beginning of the play where they talk about basically how hard women have it in Greece. And throughout the play, they're like very, they don't like what Medea is doing, but because of her circumstances, they choose not to intervene. Of course, because they would intervene because they're the chorus, but within the story, the reason given is that it's because they sympathize with Medea.
And one thing I actually got from that was when they were kind of, I feel like they had some sort of desire to kind of be as brave as Medea was with their own family, like not go out and like murder everyone, but just kind of stand up for themselves. And that's kind of like one thing that I saw, like, you know, oh, you know, or, you know, we agree with you, but like you're doing it the wrong way, kind of. Basically, it was like a moral dilemma with the both of them, between the both of them. Because, like, the corpse was like, no, no, don't do that. But, like, then they would do nothing. Mm-hmm. But they were like, you know, men deserve it, you know, because men are the worst ones. They're the, like, they're the most deceitful ones.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. They said men are the most deceitful. And that sort of portrayal of women in the first place, in Greek drama, the only other example I can think of that is The Trojan Women by Aristophanes. The thing is, Aristophanes was a satirist, so he could kind of get away with portraying women as autonomous, but the plot of The Trojan Women is that all the men in Troy refuse to stop fighting, or refuse to stop going to war, so all the Trojan women abstain from having sex with them until they agree to stop fighting. And again, Aristophanes was primarily a satirist, so he has some plausible deniability there. You know, the audience goes, oh, haha, women having autonomy, that's a riot.
Yeah.
Which is why we get into women having autonomy in this play, which is, like, again, it's Medea being herself.
Yeah, and this is a tragedy, so it's not like, you know, everybody's gonna be like, oh yeah, it's a satire. It's like, no,
this No, he's playing it completely straight, so he has no plausible deniability. And this really offended people's sensibilities of what women should be like. You know, not only should, like, women not get away with fratricide or infanticide, like Medea does all the time because she just can. And she has the tacit approval of the gods throughout this entire thing, because she is kind of not exactly human. She has, like, secret, she's a witch, and she has secret knowledge of what the gods' will is. And so, like, her, is it her cousin? Is it Circe, her cousin, or her sister?
Circe's her aunt.
Right, Circe. So her aunt Circe, originally purged her of the stain of fratricide.
And then was like, get the heck off my island.
Yeah, and then was like, get off my island. Because she killed her brother in order to escape from Colchis, from King Aetes, her father. At the end of the play, she, again, gets away with it. She understands that the Furies will not come after her. And she taunts Jason with this. He understands the Furies will not come after her. And the Furies are demons of punishment. Because Jason is an oathbreaker, which means the gods won't listen to him when he tells them that Medea killed his children.
Yeah, because he literally made an oath to, like, be her husband when they got married. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, oh yeah, here's Glaucon. Yeah. I want to be a royal. Gross. Huh?
And then they boinked on the golden fleece, which is gross.
Yes. I would not want that back at any point.
Yeah, no, it was nasty. I mean, romantic, I guess.
I brought them together, and now I don't
brought them together. But, like, so, again, all of this, what that means is that the dual portrayal of the Corinthian women as explicitly justifying Medea's actions, even if they disagree with them, or downplaying her actions, even if they find them abhorrent. The fact that Medea is many things. She is, she's a foreigner, so she's a barbarian. She's from Colchis. She is a woman. She's a powerful witch. She's a schemer, and she's not, like, a playful trickster figure. She's just, in any other play, she would be pure evil.
Yeah, and even then, you still get a sense that, you know, she's pure, like, she's evil in this play. You know she's the bad guy, but you're seeing it through the eyes of the bad guy, technically.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you kind of, I don't know, this is more, I'm saying this is more of a modern perspective, but you kind of feel bad for Medea, because she's kind of suffering through all the things, you know. Mm-hmm. One, she has the whole thing where she's a woman. You know, she's an outsider of Corinth, and she's an outsider of Greece in general, because she was brought over from Colchis. So people consider her to be a barbarian, and then they're also terrified of her because she's a sorcerer. or sorceress. I'll use sorcerer. It's easier to say. And again, because she's a sorcerer, so she's able to use these dark magics. And so basically people fear her, because even King Creon was like, you know, I don't want to, you say all these things, but I don't trust you because you're able to use magic and you hold a grudge. So basically Medea is kind of like this epitome of revenge, basically. So she's like she personifies revenge and like vengeance in general, because she's like, she does things to the utmost extremes when she's pissed off.
Right. And yeah.
So like she kind of personifies that. And for me, it's like, she's not meant to be the good guy. I don't think anyone here is a good guy except for probably King Aegeus of Athens, because he's just generally trying to be nice. Mm-hmm. but Medea is like, you sympathize with her, especially when you start seeing things through like her eyes. And it's like, well, you left me for someone else. You know, I have both your children here, or maybe more, because it depends on some of the sources. And so, or some, whoever tells a story, there might be more than two children.
Mm.
And
yeah, you know, she says in the play, I gave up everything. She basically becomes a nomad. She has no homeland.
And even after the play, she kind of roams around just like Greece in general, and just popping up here and there.
Yeah, and she, you know, she pops up as sort of like, it's just sort of a very generic witch villain who tries to undermine the hero, then gets caught, then runs away, and then rinse and repeat. That's the role she has in most other stories. I think there's a story involving Theseus where she does that.
Yeah, yes, exactly. I remember hearing it, but I can't recall which story it is, but yes, she's in one of Theseus's stories.
Right. Besides Jason and the Argonauts, because sometimes Theseus is a crew member.
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Right, and it just overall just goes to show how different the portrayal of Medea is as a character in Euripides' play versus pretty much everything else. Like she is like a major character in Jason and the Argonauts. She doesn't come into the latter half of the story, but in Jason and the Argonauts, she still has, I guess she doesn't have that much autonomy.
She has more screen time.
Yeah.
Than the crew.
Yeah. She has power. She has power in Jason and the Argonauts, but she doesn't always have autonomy.
She doesn't always have autonomy because she's basically sent one way or the other by the gods, but you actually don't see the gods showing up in the play. Except for like just them, just random things occurring that work in Medea's favor that makes you think the gods are on her side.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you think about it, Jason is technically Hera's chosen, and what is Hera the goddess of?
Family.
Family. And what did Jason marriage. Just do? Yeah, family and marriage. And Jason just did what to his family?
Oh, right. Yeah, that's a good point.
So Jason just basically broke his family. So you can see why Hera would be, as always, hateful towards people. Because, like, Jason was her chosen, like, this is my guy. Because she hates all the other demigods, but Jason's like, well, he's not Zeus's kid, so I like him. But then he goes and does this, and so basically, what I see is, like, a lot of Zeus's kids don't want to act like Zeus, but the ones who aren't Zeus's kids act the most like Zeus.
That's true.
Yeah, so that's just one idea I had, but but on the topic of like just kind of like how women are portrayed in
mm-hmm.
in Medea, so Euripides, you know, the guy who wrote the play, you know, was he a proto-feminist or was he a misogynist?
He was a misogynist. I think now that we talk more and more about it, I think Medea is a story of just having sympathy for the devil. Maybe he just thought it'd be interesting to have a play that shows both sides, basically. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm not sure if the myth before this existed.
I'm pretty sure the myth of Jason the Argonauts existed before, but it was just written down by Apollonius of Rhodes. Because, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of myths out there that were just probably transmitted orally. Just because Homer didn't write it down doesn't mean no one else did. And it was just one of those stories, because you can see it a lot on the vases, whatever. Mm-hmm. You can see like Jason and the Argonauts story like on those like ceramic vases, and so it shows up throughout history, except it wasn't written down officially like on paper or papyrus, whatever you want to call it, on a scroll, until Apollonius of Rhodes.
Right. And I think I forget if I mentioned this earlier, but I believe that it's argued that what Euripides was doing here is he was sort of making a revisionist play. Judging by how Medea is portrayed in every other story, and judging how women are portrayed in Greek mythology in general, this sort of portrayal of Medea, I think, is Euripides' own invention, or if anything, his way of trying to see Medea's side, because normally she just wouldn't, her side would not be seen, period.
Yeah. What I like about this is that you see something new as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, we've lost a lot of the Greek plays, like, and I haven't read a lot of them, but, like, in my experience, this is kind of something new that you see just because what a lot of writers do, you know, you want to make something completely new that your audience wouldn't expect, but have them expecting something. Mm-hmm. So, like, it was probably known that, you know, this happens to Jason and Medea, but, you know, in my opinion, you know, this isn't fact, most writers would just probably do this from Jason's perspective and give him like
right
the word, but
you know, yeah, I mean, Jason was the main character of Jason and the Argonauts, no matter how you slice it. Mm-hmm.
It's in the name.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, his story ends with him being crushed by the rotting hull of the Argo.
Hey, spoilers.
Hmm.
It's not like I didn't write something. Oh yeah, you know, he meets his end.
Yeah,
mass.
And I think that's
not like that's a spoiler.
Yeah, and that's written in Jason and the Argonauts by Apollonius of Rhodes, right?
Not in my copy. I had an introduction part that had like a bunch of like before and after info inside of it as well. Mm-hmm. So I kind of used that to kind of help supplement when I was reading Medea, but like. There's not like one place you can find it. It's just kind of like within other myths. But Medea does prophesize at the end of Medea that he's going to meet his doom.
So
on the carcass of his ship.
It would have been known to the audience.
Yes.
But on the topic of, is Euripides a proto-feminist or a misogynist? So my take is the, I guess the standard scholarly one, if we're being fair, you could extract anything from Euripides' play to find evidence that he's either. It's definitely unusual to portray women this way. It's definitely unusual to, you know, really have sympathy for the devil here. Because, I mean, one point against it is that you understand Medea's reasoning, but you still also understand that what she's doing is horrible.
Yeah. And it's also one of those things, like, you're seeing it from a modern perspective versus seeing it through how Euripides and, like, his audience see it. And it's, like, is Euripides trying to show something that advances women's rights or just, you know, the view on women in general? Or is he trying to show, like, oh, yeah, look at how horrible Medea is, but this would make a great tragedy?
Yeah, it really is. Like, we say this before, but in Georgia, Medea is a really popular name, and everybody knows Medea and loves Medea. But, like, why? Where's the appeal in her character?
She's one of us! Have you not ever liked, you know, historical figures? Because, like, oh, yeah, he's one of us, you know?
Not really, no.
I mean, like, growing up, at least, you know.
I can't really think of any.
I can't because, you know, I'm American, you know, Cuban race, so it's kind of hard to, oh, yeah, you know, he's American, but, like, is he Cuban? Like, even, like, 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, like, politics, American, I was a big Marco Rubio fan for the exact same reason. Oh yeah, he's Cuban American. He's one of us. Right. And like, you know, and then like once I started seeing his politics, you know, I made my mind up about him after that. I'm not going to say which way or the other, but you know, you get to make up your own opinions.
Yeah, that's tempting. You know, my my mom's side of the family is pretty much rooted in working class Irish immigrants from Boston specifically. Like most of my mom's family lives in New England in some capacity. And the whole family, not really me, I don't care either way, but my mom and her family love JFK. They loved him because he was a Catholic.
Yeah, so it's kind of like that one of us mentality, because like it doesn't matter how horrible they were, like, you know, it's you know, it's from our land, it's one of us. And it's like, well, okay, but like once you start actually looking into like stuff they did, like someone who knows what Medea did won't be like, oh yeah, I love Medea. It's like, well, she's an interesting character, but she's not like someone you should like
look up to.
But like,
yeah,
would I totally name my kid Medea after Medea? Hell yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that gets into my point. I mean, Medea can be a symbol for something beyond what she actually was in the story. One of the points that I read in a paper as I was doing for, I was reading for this discussion, was that a lot of oppressed people in general have identified with Medea because she is the one woman in a patriarchal society who stood up and took her revenge. She was active instead of passive.
So she actually did something instead of just kind of waiting for someone else to do something.
Right. And I can definitely see how this appeals to Georgians, because, now I said it last time, I don't want to make Georgians out to be perpetual victims, but they are always at the edge of empires, which means they're always like getting conquered for a short while, and then those people leave, and then they get conquered again. Even today, after the 2008 Russo-Georgian War, Russia is occupying land that most of the international community recognizes to be rightfully Georgian. So I can positively understand why the Georgians would identify with Medea.
Exactly. It's kind of like that whole exoticization from just kind of like, you know, oh yeah, because you lose your territory, and then like you have people trying to submit their values onto you, and essentially it's like, oh yeah, we need to find someone who's within, you know, our story, our history, and kind of get that up to the forefront so we can keep our culture like ongoing.
Yeah. I mean, that identification with what who is normally portrayed as a villain is like not uncommon among oppressed or minority populations. Like, for example, reclaiming the word queer in the LGBTQ community. You know, queer used to be a slur like maybe 20 years ago, I guess.
Even up to a few years ago.
Yeah, even up to a few years ago. And it's still used that way for sure. And I remember I ran at junior out of college, I ran a radio show called Out of Step. And it was all about punk rock and heavy metal. And I introduced a couple bands. I think it was Limp Wrist, which is a band of all gay men, as being in the queercore genre, as in queer hardcore punk. And my station manager was like, do you really want to use that word? And I had to explain to them, like, well, no, this is the name of the genre, and they tell people to call them a queercore band. Like, I don't know how else I would introduce, I don't know how else I would introduce the band.
Yeah. But yeah, so basically it's all about reclaiming kind of like what's yours, and that way people can't use it against you, because, you know, how can you use something against someone that, you know, they already claim to be, essentially. So it's like, you know, it's kind of like you can't use Medea against us because Medea is one of us. So it's like we're going to back her up no matter what, even like because I can't speak for the Georgians, but I can speak for myself as an American. If someone came up to me came up to me and was like, oh yeah, because Teddy Roosevelt was came to Brazil for a while. He's Brazilian, you know? So it was like, he, you know, he's ours. And it's like, no, like he's from the US. So Teddy Roosevelt's like one of us. You can't take, you know, someone from our land and just say they're yours just because they lived there or they were there for a while.
Mm-hmm. Which is weird because, again, Medea is portrayed as not having a homeland, as having betrayed her homeland, actually.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, not that Teddy Roosevelt did, but, like...
Right.
We're not going to talk... It's my favorite president. We're not going to talk smack about Teddy.
Yeah, fair enough.
Okay.
But, you know, Medea, in the end, it's just a story, and people can...
Yeah.
Stories can change over time. Medea can transform from, a clear villainess... to an anti-hero, to, you know, a full-on symbol of struggle against oppression. Hmm. And, you know, even if Medea really, realistically, I don't think Medea is a hero in, nobody's a hero in this play.
No, it's a tragedy.
Yeah, no, it's a tragedy. Right. I mean, okay, even technically Macbeth is a tragedy and there's a hero of Macbeth.
Macbeth?
Yeah, Macduff, right?
Wait, whatever his name is.
Yeah, Macduff, because, I don't know. Because I remember it because I always like the scene with the weird sisters with the with the vision they give him. But anyway, we'll get to witches later. Well, actually, we can just do it now.
We can get to witches now. Now they're thinking about witches.
Yeah, so anyway, the paper I was reading... again, it acknowledged, like, realistically, Euripides is not a proto-feminist. But you, I mean, you're still allowed to look back onto the character of Medea and see her as a proto-feminist icon, if you want.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, just because Euripides didn't mean to do that doesn't mean, like, you can't. Because, like, just because someone didn't mean to do something, like, doesn't mean, like, you can still do it. Because, like, sometimes, like, you know, if I say something, you take it the wrong way. Like, it's kind of hard for me, and lots of people start taking it, you know, the way I didn't mean to be, mm-hmm. for it to be taken. It's like, well, that's just their interpretation of it. And all because someone wrote something a certain way doesn't mean, like, that it should be taken that way.
Yeah. Or even what I do, a lot of the time when I watch a movie, I have a lot of thoughts about it, and I like to write it down. And most of the time, I look it up later and realize that my interpretation is off. But I...
How is it off if it's your interpretation?
Well, I guess, I mean, well, if I interpret something as like, okay, I don't know, my interpretation of Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut is that it's about paranoia and conspiracy theories. Yeah, it's about paranoia and conspiracy theories. And I could find out later, like, you know, Kubrick didn't really think of things that way. It was like, okay, fine. Maybe I was factually incorrect about Kubrick's interpretations or Kubrick's intentions when he was making it. But I still like to use it as a jumping off point to talk about things. You know, or mm-hmm. you could even just get the complete cop out and say that he did it unconsciously, because then nobody can prove you wrong.
Exactly. Well, back to the witches. Medea is a witch, or sorceress, or whatever you want to call her. If you play D&D, there's a clear difference.
Right. The words are basically interchangeable. And just like Medea is a pretty clear either villainess or anti-hero, who's later reinterpreted as a feminist icon... We do pretty much the same thing with all witches nowadays. The two movies I can think of off the top of my head, neither of which I've seen, but I know they exist, are The Craft, which is like an aggressively 90s movie. and the other was The Witches of Eastwick, which I saw part of on TV when I was like a kid. And what I remember from that is that Jack Nicholson plays Satan in that movie, which is pretty cool.
As he should.
Yeah, no, I mean, he was a great Satan. He comes off as like an extremely nice guy in interviews and behind the scenes footage. I was looking at behind the scenes footage for The Shining, the other day, and he comes off as extremely nice and polite. I don't know if it's how he really was in real life, but he's really good at turning on like the evil like that.
Yeah. So you were talking about the craft and the Witches of Eastwick.
Right, the Witches of Eastwick. So, like, of course, we all know what witches are in the classical sense. Everybody knows about the Salem Witch Trials. Everybody knows about the Wizard of Oz. Everybody knows about, what's another evil witch in fiction or literature?
Narnia.
Yeah, Narnia. Why not? I love Narnia.
Yeah, have all your books here.
Yeah, no, I sent them over for Christmas. I sent you that history book, too, about the...
Cherokee. Yes.
Yeah, Cherokee. I forgot if I ended up sending that one.
You did. I have it in my bookshelf.
Okay, cool. But anyway, so this is how witches are classically portrayed. They're emissaries of Satan, or they get their power from Satan.
For evil.
Yeah, they're used for evil. They kidnap children and eat them or use them to make paste or ointment for which with the fly, so on and so forth. But like, I guess in the first place, in the craft, I understand that their powers are based off the real life religion of Wiccanism. And I don't know, that's how the director wanted to say they get their powers from. And all the movie is based on that. Yeah, I don't know how much Wiccans appreciate that portrayal. I doubt they care, or they just love it. My guess is, since it's sort of like a, I don't know if it's a countercultural. It's not. I don't know if it's a countercultural movie, but it has like a really hot goth girl in it. So, I guess that's enough to count as countercultural in today's day and age.
Yeah. But actually, one point I did want to bring up before I forgot about it was you can kind of see like. The witch kind of being like, you know, the woman in power who's just essentially kind of, because she's in power, she's being portrayed as evil.
Yeah, basically. That's how it was with
Medea. Yeah. And that's how it was with Medea, because, you know, she has these things. She's able to, like, make potions and, like, use magic. And she's seen as evil because all the other women can't even do that. So, you know, they're passively good. But, in Sirius, like, Wizard of Oz. You know, you have the two evil witches, one of who dies at the beginning. And then you have the two, like, good witches of the north and south. Or I might be getting my directions mixed up.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, even then, the good witches are, like, very minor characters.
They're very minor characters.
They have no autonomy.
Yeah, they basically just follow whatever. And then still, like, Oz is ruled by Oz.
You're like... They're very aloof, which is like, it serves the story because Dorothy has to do everything herself. Otherwise, the movie would be incredibly boring.
She still has her companions are the ones who do a lot of everything.
Yeah, but they learn a lesson. That's true. Actually, yeah, Dorothy is extremely passive in that movie now, I think. Now that I think about it.
But it's great when you're with Pink Floyd in the background.
Yeah, that's true. Man, that was a really psychedelic movie.
Yeah, but basically, yeah, like, Dorothy has no autonomy. The only character with autonomy that's a female is the Wicked Witch.
Right.
And even then, it's in her name, the Wicked Witch. So, they're still portrayed as evil, and even if the good witches are just kind of, they're just kind of there as, like, a fairy godmother-esque kind of character. Right. So they're either kind of there to, like, kind of help along, like, with everything, and they have no autonomy because, you know, they're there to help the main character. But then you have like the good, you know, the evil woman who wants to rule everything and have her own power over stuff, and she's the evil witch.
Right, and so, all of this is a really apt metaphor, or I think it was intended that way, unconsciously or not. It was all an apt metaphor for how threatening powerful women were, out of the societies which these. Works of fiction were coming.
It actually reminds me of like one of the lines Medea says is like, you know, there's nothing more dangerous than scheming woman. I have it written down here. So
yeah. I mean, it's. I wouldn't be surprised if that's the originator of the idiom, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. So we were talking about, well, anyway, I guess, so this, of course, what we're all saying here is the standard feminist reinterpretation of witches. And that was the point behind The Craft and The Witches of Eastwick and all feminist reinterpretations of Medea, which is that, well, of course, men would portray powerful women like that, because it's threatening to their society, you know. And generally speaking, Medea checks all of these boxes. She's a foreigner, so that's threatening to Greek society, which shows she's a barbarian.
Yeah, so as you mentioned in the last discussion we had, she's basically a very exoticized character. Right. So like, and because she's exoticized, she doesn't have a homeland in Greece, but she can't return to her own homeland, which is actually one thing that is mentioned multiple times in the play Medea, is that, you know, I have no sanctuary because I can't even return back to my father.
Right.
And I'll be destitute anywhere I go in Greece because I have no one to turn to.
Yeah. If anything, this play is kind of a cautionary tale because it really isn't until Medea is banished from Corinth that it becomes a self, King Aegis, what's his name? Who's the king of Corinth?
Creon.
It's not until King Creon, he makes a self-fulfilling prophecy by banishing Medea from Corinth, because now she has nothing to lose. She has no homeland. Being exiled in ancient Greece is not quite a death sentence, but it's pretty close, because you need protection from the wilderness within the walls of a city-state like Athens or Corinth or Colchis.
Yeah, and basically because Medea herself said, don't banish me. I will be quiet. I will be submissive to my betters. Just don't kick me out of Colchis or out of Corinth.
Well, Creon knows that she's lying.
Well, she might not have been. We don't know. Like she would have just probably stayed pissed. She would have probably done something just to Jason. But, like, but Creon can always find a new daughter, a new suitor for Glaucia, his daughter. So, like, she might have done something to Jason because she's so pissed off at him. But, like, who knows? But she was threatening Glaucia and Jason, so who knows? She would have, knowing Medea, she would have done something, actually.
Right. But anyway, so Medea checks all of these boxes of things which are, generally speaking, threatening. She's a foreigner. She's an ultra foreigner because she has no homeland. Which is also, this is the thing that gives her power, because she has nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. So she's a nomad. She has no loyalties. She's not even to her own children. So there's no loyalties to the social order whatsoever. She's a powerful woman who will assert her own will, at the cost of everything, at the cost of social ties, at the cost of safety. And she's also not exactly human.
She's like a quarter god, basically.
Yeah. No, normally, being a demigod gives you an immense amount of power. But Medea is a scary character. She's the priestess of Hecate, which we mentioned last time. Hecate is a goddess of magic. I think her parents are like the Knight and Tartarus or some other quote-unquote evil god.
She's basically the antithesis to Apollo, essentially.
Right, yeah. And she's the goddess of crossroads. And what is a crossroad? It's a place where you don't know which you're making a choice. And making choices are scary. It's liminal.
Well, she's actually, in most depictions of Hecate, you also see like three figures, three women figures.
Right. So she's also a goddess of change. Mm-hmm. And these are all, again, all things that all human beings generally find threatening. It makes perfect sense that Medea is a nomad with no loyalties, because Hecate herself has a ambiguous characterization. Mm-hmm. And that's really what her characterization is, ambiguity itself.
Yeah, and it goes back to also Hecate's a witch as well.
Yeah, she's the goddess of magic.
So essentially, you can see already that the Greeks were just kind of putting women to this whole, Hecate's evil because she does magic, so evil women do magic.
Yeah.
Kind of thing, and it's already kind of like, it was already ingrained in their system, and since we took a lot from the Greeks just over the years, or the centuries, millennia.
Yeah.
It just kind of makes sense.
Yeah, so you get like a checklist of, checklist of qualities that are applied to evil characters. Darkness, ambiguity, femininity, rootlessness in terms of, rootlessness, I guess, also is just ambiguity said twice. But the final point is that Medea has, again, many divine qualities. At the end of the play, she escapes in a flying chariot. Sometimes it's drawn by serpents, sometimes it's drawn by dragons, depending on the source. And that sort of stagecraft is normally reserved for a god. That's where this term Deus Ex Machina, God on a crane, comes from, because that's how a lot of Greek dramas ended. Once all these problems started piling up, a god would come in and just fix everything through to their divine power. Obviously, that doesn't happen here in the play, but nevertheless, Medea gets her own Deus Ex Machina ending where she plays the part of a god. Mm-hmm. So she could almost say she ascends to godhood once she lets go of all of her ties that made her human, like her loyalty to Corinth, her loyalty to her children, and her loyalty to Jason. Once all her ties are gone, she ascends to godhood. Mm-hmm. And again, she has somehow access to divine knowledge. She taunts Jason by saying, I know the Furies aren't going to come after me because the gods will never listen to an oathbreaker. So she knows what the loopholes are in the rules. Just like her aunt Circe did, like she was just able to wash away her fratricide, which is the cardinal sin of ancient Greece is fratricide. Circe just washes it away. Briefly aside, I also like Circe a lot as a character too. Mm-hmm. Because she's a witch and she like turns Odysseus' men into pigs. But he also just like stays on her island for like how many years just to be with her?
Well, I thought he was forced, or was that with Calypso?
I think he stays voluntarily with Calypso. I'm not sure. I think he's
It might be the reverse, but we're not here to talk about Odysseus, but it might be, I think he was forced to stay with Calypso, but he kind of just stayed with Circe, but he might have still been faithful to his wife.
I mean, this whole time Penelope has been rejecting suitors this entire time. Mm-hmm.
I think we're getting close to the end here. Mm-hmm. So the last point was, after reading Jason the Argonauts, I was like, okay, Jason, you have a chance of still getting on my good side. Yeah. Then I read Medea, and I'm like, Jason, you are a horrible person. You cheated on your wife and your deadbeat father. Mm-hmm. And I love what Medea said to him at the end. It was like, oh, now you love them. Now you want to kiss them. Then you did it. And I was like, oh, I can hear like my mom saying that to somebody.
Yeah, but probably one of the greatest roasts in the history of literature.
Yeah, I was like, you would do all that, but now that they're dead, when they were alive, you didn't want to do anything with them. Like, you just wanted to be with, Miss Royal Princess over there, who's not that smart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, he says like, what he says something about, and now you left the land of barbarians and dwelt among the Greeks. Aren't you grateful? Something along those lines.
Yeah, literally. And it was like,
that was the point where I completely checked out of having any sympathy for Jason.
I was like, oh, you know, you chose to do this. Like, and even then before, he's like, oh yeah, the gods made, you know, forced you to love me. Yeah. So like, you know, no biggie. So it's not my fault you love me. The gods forced you to. And I was like, okay.
And
but if the gods forced her to do that, you know, it must mean something if the gods forced made it happen.
Right. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's a whole theme of Oedipus Rex, but we'll not get into that. I mean, notably, Jason is like, you know, Jason has like a totally unsympathetic betrayal, but this whole thing could have been avoided if he just said that he needs to guarantee his line. You know, he would still be an oath breaker, but maybe this whole thing could have been avoided. Maybe Medea wouldn't have murdered his children. Who knows? But
if he talked to his wife,
yeah, I know.
You know, before he started doing anything,
communicate. You know, this is the key to relationships. It's communication.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, and like, I don't know, because like, even then, like, my dad would probably still be pissed off, because like, you still want to leave me for that person? You know, I killed your uncle. I had your uncle killed for this. And then like, because she, you know, it's briefly mentioned Medea, but she basically forced like Jason's cousins, Pelias' daughters, to kill Pelias. Mm-hmm. Or like, she kind of, she didn't force them to, but she was like, oh yeah, look, you see this like potion that I used to like make the sheep look super young?
Yeah.
So totally use it on your dad to make him young again.
Well, but, you know, maybe the gods shouldn't have made those kids so stupid.
Right? It's like, you know, literally, she's married to the guy who wants your dad off the throne. You're going to believe her. Okay.
Who is Pelias again?
Pelias is the king of Iolcus, or Jason's uncle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But yeah, he got killed by his own daughters.
Oh, right. No, sorry. That wasn't in Medea. That was in Jason and the Argonauts.
It wasn't in my copy, so I was kind of... I'm kind of pissed off that it didn't have that ending, because they kind of like finish off in like the city, like the island of like one of the islands, and they throw a festival, and then it's like, all right, game over. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
I swear there's more to this.
You can tell that Apollonius of Rhodes didn't want to make it a sad ending, because I mean, okay, yeah, there's fratricide, but then Medea. I mean, the eternal motif with, like we said in the summary, is that the eternal motif with Medea is, so what's your plan? Murder. The plan is murder.
Yep. All right, Brendan, I think we're going to end the our discussion here. It was a pleasure to have you.
It was good to be back.
We'll see you next week. We'll see you in 2 weeks' time for Mirani.
Actually, yeah, I'm excited for this one because I don't know anything about it, so...
Yeah, so just a quick thing for everyone. Amirani is going to be like the actual first like Georgian thing we talk about. That's not just like, oh yeah, random, you know, here's the Colchian tribe and here's this tribe and here's what we don't know and here's what we know. It's like, oh no, actual, like, we get an actual person to talk about that is, you know, that's in Georgia, in the land of Georgia. The whole story takes place in Georgia. I'm excited because it's actually something like outside of Greek stuff, and it's actually like a creation myth kind of thing, and it's actually like Georgian mythology.
Yeah, sweet. I would love to learn a lot more about Georgian mythology, so I'm looking forward to getting that script.
Yeah. So thank you for coming on, and we'll see you in 2 weeks' time.
See you in 2 weeks.
Brendan, once again, thank you for the enlightening discussion. I can't wait to finally go into the Georgian Prometheus, Amirani, with you next week. That will be our last myth episode before returning to our narrative. As I've mentioned before, if we're not on any streaming service, please let me know, and I'll attempt to get onto it. If you do have anything you want to say, feel free to look us up on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram as The History of Sakartvelo Georgia, on Twitter at History_Georgia, on our website at historyofsakartvelo.com, or on our email at thehistoryofsakartvelogeorgia@gmail.com. Sakartvelo is spelled S-A-Q-A-R-T-V-E-L.